Chapter 32. Rama is raised from the dead. Now a certain man was sick, named Lazarus. When Jesus heard that, he said, "This sickness is not unto death, but for the glory of God, that the Son of God might be glorified thereby." Sri Yukteswar was expounding the Christian scriptures one sunny morning on the balcony of his Serampore hermitage. Besides a few of the master's other disciples, I was present with a small group of my Ranchi students. In this passage, Jesus calls himself the Son of God. Though he was truly united with God, his reference here has a deep, impersonal significance, my guru explained. The Son of God is the Christ, or divine consciousness in man. No mortal can glorify God. The only honour that man can pay his Creator is to seek him. Man cannot glorify an abstraction that he does not know. The glory, or nimbus around the head of the saints, is a symbolic witness of their capacity to render divine homage. Sri Yukteswar went on to read the marvellous story of Lazarus's resurrection. At its conclusion, Master fell into a long silence, the sacred book open on his knee. I too was privileged to behold a similar miracle, my guru finally spoke with solemn unction. Lahiri Mahashai resurrected one of my friends from the dead. The young lads at my side smiled with keen interest. There was enough of the boy in me, too, to enjoy not only the philosophy, but in particular, any story I could get Sri Yukteswar to relate about his wondrous experiences with his guru. My friend Rama and I were inseparable, Master began. Because he was shy and reclusive, he chose to visit our guru Lahiri Mahashai only during the hours between midnight and dawn, when the crowd of daytime disciples was absent. As I was Rama's closest friend, he confided to me many of his deep spiritual experiences. I found inspiration in his ideal companionship. My guru's face softened with memories. Rama was suddenly put to a severe test, Sri Yukteswar continued. He contracted the disease of Asiatic cholera. As our master never objected to the services of physicians at times of serious illness, two specialists were summoned. Amidst the frantic rush of ministering to the stricken man, I was deeply praying to Lahiri Mahashai for help. I hurried to his home and sobbed out the story. "The doctors are seeing Rama. He will be well," my guru smiled jovially. I returned with a light heart to my friend's bedside, only to find him in a dying state. "He cannot last more than 1 or 2 hours," one of the physicians told me with a gesture of despair. Once more, I hastened to Lahiri Mahashai. "The doctors are conscientious men. I'm sure Rama will be well." The master dismissed me blithely. At Rama's place, I found both doctors gone. One had left me a note. "We have done our best, but his case is hopeless." My friend was indeed the picture of a dying man. I did not understand how Lahiri Mahashai's words could fail to come true, yet the sight of Rama's rapidly ebbing life kept suggesting to my mind, all is over now. Tossing thus on alternating waves of faith and doubt, I ministered to my friend as best I could. He roused himself to cry out, "Yukteswar, run to Master and tell him I am gone. Ask him to bless my body before its last rites." With these words, Rama sighed heavily and gave up the ghost. I wept for an hour by his bedside. Always a lover of quiet, now he had attained the utter stillness of death. Another disciple came in. I asked him to remain in the house until I returned. Half dazed, I trudged back to my guru. "How is Rama now?" Lahiri Mahashai's face was wreathed in smiles. "Sir, you will soon see how he is," I blurted out emotionally. "In a few hours you will see his body, before it is carried to the crematory grounds." I broke down and moaned openly. "Yukteswar, control yourself, sit calmly and meditate." My guru retired into Samadhi. The afternoon and night passed in unbroken silence. I struggled unsuccessfully to regain an inner composure. At dawn, Lahiri Mahashai glanced at me consolingly. "I see you are still disturbed. Why didn't you explain yesterday that you expected me to give Rama tangible aid in the form of some medicine?" The master pointed to a cup-shaped lamp containing crude castor oil. "Fill a little bottle with the oil from the lamp. Put 7 drops in Rama's mouth." "Sir," I remonstrated, "he has been dead since yesterday noon. Of what use is the oil now?"
"Never mind. Just do as I ask."
My guru's cheerful mood was incomprehensible to me. I was still in an unassuaged agony of bereavement. Pouring out a small amount of oil, I departed for Rama's house. I found my friend's body rigid in the death clasp. Paying no attention to his ghastly condition, I opened his lips with my right index finger and managed, with my left hand and the help of the cork, to put the oil drop by drop over his clenched teeth. As the 7th drop touched his cold lips, Rama shivered violently. His muscles from head to foot vibrated as he sat up wonderingly. "I saw Lahiri Mahashai in a blaze of light," he cried. "He shone like the sun." "Arise, forsake your sleep," he commanded me. "Come with Yukteswar to see me." I could scarcely believe my eyes when Rama dressed himself and was strong enough after that fatal sickness to walk to the home of our guru. There he prostrated himself before Lahiri Mahashai with tears of gratitude. The master was beside himself with mirth. His eyes twinkled at me mischievously. "Yukteswar," he said, "surely henceforth you will not fail to carry with you a bottle of castor oil. Whenever you see a corpse, just administer the oil. Why, 7 drops of lamp oil must surely foil the power of Yama."
"Guruji, you are ridiculing me. I don't understand. Please point out the nature of my error."
"I told you twice that Rama would be well. Yet you could not fully believe me," Lahiri Mahashai explained. "I did not mean that doctors would be able to cure him. I remarked only that they were in attendance. I didn't want to interfere with the physicians. They have to live too." In a voice resounding with joy, my guru added, "Always know that the omnipotent Param Atman can heal anyone, doctor or no doctor."
"I see my mistake," I acknowledged remorsefully. "I know now that your simple word is binding on the whole cosmos." As Sri Yukteswar finished the awesome story, one of the Ranchi lads ventured a question that from a child was doubly understandable. "Sir," he said, "why did your guru send castor oil?" Child, giving the oil had no special meaning. Because I had expected something material, Lahiri Mahashai chose the nearby oil as an objective symbol to awaken my greater faith. The master allowed Rama to die because I had partially doubted. But the divine guru knew that inasmuch as he had said the disciple would be well, the healing must take place, even though he had to cure Rama of death, a disease usually final. Sri Yukteswar dismissed the little group and motioned me to a blanket seat at his feet. "Yogananda," he said with unusual gravity, "you have been surrounded from birth by direct disciples of Lahiri Mahashai. The great master lived his sublime life in partial seclusion and steadfastly refused to permit his followers to build any organization around his teachings. He made, nevertheless, a significant prediction. About 50 years after my passing," he said, "an account of my life will be written because of a deep interest in yoga that will arise in the West. The message of yoga will encircle the globe. It will aid in establishing the brotherhood of man, a unity based on humanity's direct perception of the One Father. My son Yogananda," Sri Yukteswar went on, "you must do your part in spreading that message and in writing that sacred life." 50 years after Lahiri Mahashai's passing in 1895, culminated in 1945, the year of completion of this present book, I cannot but be struck by the coincidence that the year 1945 has also ushered in a new age,
the era of revolutionary atomic energies. All thoughtful minds turn as never before to the urgent problems of peace and brotherhood, lest the continued use of physical force banish all men along with the problems. Though the works of the human race disappear tracelessly by time or bomb, the sun does not falter in its course. The stars keep their invariable vigil. Cosmic law cannot be stayed or changed, and man would do well to put himself in harmony with it. If the cosmos is against might, if the sun wars not in the heavens, but retires at a dutiful time to give the stars their little sway, what avails our mailed fist? Shall any peace come out of it? Not cruelty, but goodwill upholds the universal sinews. A humanity at peace will know the endless fruits of victory, sweeter to the taste than any nurtured on the soil of blood. The effective League of Nations will be a natural, nameless league of human hearts. The broad sympathies and discerning insight needed for the healing of earthly woes cannot flow from a mere intellectual consideration of human diversities, but from knowledge of men's deepest unity, kinship with God. Toward realization of the world's highest ideal, peace through brotherhood, may yoga, the science of personal communion with the divine, spread in time to all men in all lands. Though India possesses a civilization more ancient than that of any other country, few historians have noted that her feat of survival is by no means an accident, but a logical incident in the record of devotion to the eternal verities that India has offered through her best men in every generation. By sheer continuity of being, by intransitivity before the ages, can dusty scholars truly tell us how many, India has given the worthiest answer of any people to the challenge of time. The biblical story of Abraham's plea to the Lord that the city of Sodom be spared if 10 righteous men could be found therein, and the divine reply, "I will not destroy it for 10's sake," gained new meaning in the light of India's escape from oblivion. Gone are the empires of mighty nations, skilled in the arts of war, that once were India's contemporaries. Ancient Egypt, Babylonia, Greece, Rome. The Lord's answer clearly shows that a land lives not in its material achievements, but in its masterpieces of man. Let the divine words be heard again in this 20th century, twice dyed in blood ere half over. No nation that can produce 10 men who are great in the eyes of the unbribable judge shall know extinction. Heeding such persuasions, India has proved herself not witless against the 1,000 cunnings of time. Self-realized masters in every century have hallowed her soil. Modern, Christ-like sages, like Lahiri Mahashai and Sri Yukteswar, rise up to proclaim that a knowledge of yoga, the science of God-realization, is vital to man's happiness and to a nation's longevity. Very scanty information about the life of Lahiri Mahashai and his universal doctrine has ever appeared in print. For 3 decades in India, America, and Europe, I have found a deep and sincere interest in his message of liberating yoga. A written account of the master's life, even as he foretold, is now needed in the West, where lives of the great modern yogis are little known. Lahiri Mahashai was born on September 30th, 1828, into a pious Brahmin family of ancient lineage. His birthplace was the village of Gurney in the Nadia district near Krishnanagar, Bengal. He was the only son of Muktakashi, second wife of the esteemed Gau Mahan Lahiri, whose first wife, after the birth of 3 sons, had died during a pilgrimage. The boy's mother passed away during his childhood. We have little information about her, except a revealing fact. She was an ardent devotee of Lord Shiva, scripturally designated as the King of Yogis. The boy, whose full name was Shyama Sharan Lahiri, spent his early years at the ancestral home in Gurney.
At the age of 3 or 4, he was often observed sitting under the sands in a certain yoga posture, his body completely hidden except for the head. The Lahiri estate was destroyed in the winter of 1833, when the nearby Jalangi River changed its course and disappeared into the depths of the Ganges. One of the Shiva temples, founded by the Lahiris, went into the river along with the family home. A devotee rescued the stone image of Lord Shiva from the swirling waters and placed it in a new temple, now well known as the Gurney Shiva site. Gaur Mohan Lahiri and his family left Gurney and became residents of Banaras, where the father immediately erected the Shiva temple. He conducted his household along the lines of Vedic discipline, with regular observance of ceremonial worship, acts of charity, and scriptural study. Just and open-minded, however, he did not ignore the beneficial current of modern ideas. The boy Lahiri took lessons in Hindi and Urdu in Banaras study groups. He attended a school conducted by Joy Narayan Ghoshal, receiving instruction in Sanskrit, Bengali, French, and English. Applying himself to a close study of the Vedas, the young yogi listened eagerly to scriptural discussions by learned Brahmins, including a Maratha pundit named Nag Bhatta. Shami Charan was a kind, gentle, and courageous youth, beloved by all his companions. With a well-proportioned, healthy, and powerful body, he excelled in swimming and in many feats of manual skill. In 1846, Shama Charan Lahiri was married to Srimati Kashi Muni, daughter of Sri Debnarayan Sanyal. A model Indian housewife, Kashi Muni cheerfully performed her home duties and observed the householder's obligation to serve guests and the poor. Two saintly sons, Tinkuri and Dukuri, and two daughters blessed the union. At the age of 23, in 1851, Lahiri Mahashai took the post of accountant in the Military Engineering Department of the British government. He received many promotions during the time of his service. Thus, not only was he a master before God's eyes, but also a success in the little human drama in which he played a humble role as an office worker in the world. At various times, the engineering department transferred Lahiri Mahashai to its offices in Ghazipur, Mirjapur, Nainital, Danapur, and Banaras. After the death of his father, the young man assumed responsibility for the members of his entire family. He bought for them a home in the secluded Garudeshwar Mohalla neighbourhood of Banaras. It was in his 33rd year that Lahiri Mahashai saw fulfilment of the purpose for which he had reincarnated on earth. He met his great guru, Babaji, near Raniket in the Himalayas, and was initiated by him into Kriya Yoga. This auspicious event did not happen to Lahiri Mahashai alone. It was a fortunate moment for all the human race. The lost or long-vanished highest art of yoga was again being brought to light. As the Ganges came from heaven to earth, in the Puranic story, offering a divine draught to the parched devotee, Bhagirath, so in 1861, the celestial river of Kriya Yoga began to flow from the secret fastnesses of the Himalayas into the dusty haunts of men. Chapter 33. Babaji, Yogi Christ of Modern India. The northern Himalayan crags near Badri Narayan are still blessed by the living presence of Babaji, Guru of Lahiri Mahashai. The secluded master has retained his physical form for centuries, perhaps for millenniums. The deathless Babaji is an avatara. This Sanskrit word means descent. Its roots are ava, down, and tree, to pass. In the Hindu scriptures, avatara signifies the descent of divinity into flesh. Babaji's spiritual state is beyond human comprehension, Sri Yukteswar explained to me. The dwarfed vision of men cannot pierce to his transcendental star. One attempts in vain even to picture the avatar's attainment. It is inconceivable. The Upanishads have minutely classified every stage of spiritual advancement.
a Siddha, perfected being, has progressed from the state of a Jivanmukta, freed while living, to that of a Paramukta, supremely free, full power over death. The latter has completely escaped from the Mayic thraldom and its reincarnational round. The Paramukta therefore seldom returns to a physical body. If he does return, he is an avatar, a divinely appointed medium of supernal blessings on the world. An avatar is unsubject to the universal economy. His pure body, visible as a light image, is free from any debt to nature. The casual gaze may see nothing extraordinary in an avatar's form, but on occasion it casts no shadow nor makes any footprint on the ground. These are outward symbolic proofs of an inward freedom from darkness and material bondage. Such a God-man alone knows the truth behind the relativities of life and death. Omar Khayyam, so grossly misunderstood, sang of this liberated man in the immortal scripture, the Rubaiyat. Ah, moon of my delight, who knowest no wane, the moon of heavens rising once again, how oft hereafter rising shall she look through this same garden after me in vain. The moon of delight, who knowest no wane, is God, eternal Polaris, anachronous never. The moon of heaven rising once again is the outward cosmos, fettered to the law of periodic recurrence. Through self-realization, the Persian seer had forever freed himself from compulsory returns to earth, the garden of nature or Maya. How oft hereafter rising shall she look after me in vain? What frustration of search by a wandering universe for an absolute omission. Christ expressed his freedom in another way. And a certain scribe came and said unto him, Master, I will follow thee whithersoever thou goest. And Jesus saith unto him, The foxes have holes, and the birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man hath not where to lay his head. Spacious with omnipresence, could Christ indeed be followed except in the overarching spirit? Krishna, Rama, Buddha, and Patanjali were among the ancient Indian avatars. A considerable poetic literature in Tamil has grown up around Agastya, a South Indian avatar. He worked many miracles during the centuries preceding and following the Christian era, and is credited with retaining his physical form even to this day. Babaji's mission in India has been to assist prophets in carrying out their special dispensations. He thus qualifies for the scriptural classification of Mahavatar, Great Avatar. He has stated that he gave yoga initiation to Shankara, reorganizer of the Swami order, and to Kabir, famous medieval master. The chief 19th century disciple was, as we know, Lahiri Mahashai, revivalist of the lost Kriya art. Babaji is ever in communion with Christ. Together they send out vibrations of redemption and have planned the spiritual technique of salvation for this age. The work of these two fully illumined masters, one with a body and one without a body, is to inspire the nations to forsake wars, race hatred, religious sectarianism, and the boomerang evils of materialism. Babaji is well aware of the trend of modern times, especially of the influence and complexities of Western civilization, and realizes the necessity of spreading the self-liberations of yoga equally in the West and the East. That there is no historical reference to Babaji need not surprise us. The great guru has never openly appeared in any century. The misinterpreting glare of publicity has no place in his millennial plans. Like the Creator, the sole but silent power, Babaji works in a humble obscurity. Great prophets like Christ and Krishna come to earth for a specific and spectacular purpose. They depart as soon as it is accomplished. Other avatars, like Babaji, undertake work that is concerned more with the slow evolutionary progress of man during the centuries than with any one outstanding event of history. Such masters always veil themselves from the gross public gaze and have the power to become invisible at will. For these reasons, and because they generally instruct their disciples to maintain silence about them, a number of towering spiritual figures remain world unknown. I give in these pages on Babaji merely a hint of his life, only a few facts that he deems fitting and helpful to be publicly imparted. No limiting facts about Babaji's family or birthplace, dear to the analyst's heart, have ever been discovered. His speech is generally in Hindi, but he converses easily in any language. He has adopted the simple name of Babaji, revered father. Other titles of respect given him by Lahiri Mahashaya's disciples are Mahamuni Babaji Maharaj, Supreme Ecstatic Master, Mahayogi, the Great Yogi, and Trambak Baba or Shiva Baba, titles of avatars of Shiva. Does it matter that we know not the patronymic of a fully released master? Whenever anyone utters with reverence the name of Babaji, Lahiri Mahashaya said, that devotee attracts an instant spiritual blessing. The deathless guru bears no mark of age on his body. He appears to be a youth of not more than 25. Fair-skinned, of medium build and height, Babaji's beautiful strong body radiates a perceptible glow. His eyes are dark, calm and tender. His long, lustrous hair is copper-coloured. Sometimes Babaji's face closely resembles that of Lahiri Mahashaya. On occasion, the similarity was so striking that Lahiri Mahashaya in his later years might have passed as the father of the youthful-looking Babaji. Swami Kabalananda, my saintly Sanskrit tutor, spent some time with Babaji in the Himalayas. The peerless master moves with his group from place to place in the mountains, Kabalananda told me. His small band contains two highly advanced American disciples. After Babaji has been in one locality for some time, he says, Dera Danda Uthau, let us lift our camp and staff. He carries a danda, bamboo staff. His words are the signal for moving with his group instantaneously to another place. He does not always employ this method of astral travel. Sometimes he goes on foot from peak to peak. Babaji can be seen or recognized by others only when he so desires. He is known to have appeared in many slightly different forms to various devotees, sometimes with beard and moustache, and sometimes without them. His undecayable body requires no food. The master, therefore, seldom eats. As a social courtesy to visiting disciples, he occasionally accepts fruits or rice cooked in milk and clarified butter. Two amazing incidents of Babaji's life are known to me, Kabalananda went on. His disciples were sitting one night around a huge fire that was blazing for a sacred Vedic ceremony. The guru suddenly seized a burning brand and lightly struck the bare shoulder of a chela who was close to the fire. Sir, how cruel! Lahiri Mahashaya, who was present, made this remonstrance. Would you rather have seen him burned to ashes before your eyes, according to the decree of his past karma? With these words, Babaji placed his healing hand on the chela's disfigured shoulder. I have freed you tonight from painful death. The karmic law has been satisfied through your slight suffering by fire. On another occasion, Babaji's sacred circle was disturbed by the arrival of a stranger. He had climbed with astonishing skill to the nearly inaccessible ledge near the guru's camp. Sir, you must be the great Babaji. The man's face was lit with inexpressible reverence. For months, I have pursued a ceaseless search for you among these forbidding crags. I implore you to accept me as a disciple. When the great guru made no response, the man pointed to the rock-lined chasm below the ledge. If you refuse me, I will jump from this mountain. Life has no further value
if I cannot win your guidance to the divine.
Jump, then, Babaji said unemotionally. I cannot accept you in your present state of development.
The man immediately hurled himself over the cliff.
Babaji instructed the shocked disciples to fetch the stranger's body.
After they had returned with the mangled form, the master placed his hand on the dead man.
Lo, he opened his eyes and prostrated himself humbly before the omnipotent guru.
You are now ready for discipleship.
Babaji beamed lovingly on his resurrected chela.
You have courageously passed a difficult test. Death shall not touch you again. Now you are one of our immortal flock.
Then he spoke his usual words of departure. Dera danda utao. The whole group vanished from the mountain.
An avatar lives in the omnipresent spirit. For him there is no distance inverse to the square.
Only one reason, therefore, motivates Babaji in maintaining his physical form from century to century.
The desire to furnish humanity with a concrete example of its own possibilities.
Were man never vouchsafed a glimpse of divinity in the flesh, he would remain oppressed by the heavy Mayic delusion that he cannot transcend his mortality.
Jesus knew from the beginning the sequence of his life.
He passed through each event not for himself, not from any karmic compulsion, but solely for the upliftment of reflective human beings.
The four evangelists, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, recorded the ineffable drama for the benefit of later generations.
For Babaji also, there is no relativity of past, present, future.
From the beginning, he has known all phases of his life.
Accommodating himself to the limited understanding of men, he has played many acts of his divine life in the presence of one or more witnesses.
Thus it came about that a disciple of Lahiri Mahashai was present when Babaji deemed the time to be ripe for him to proclaim the possibility of bodily immortality.
He uttered this promise before Ram Gopal Muzumdar, that it might finally become known for the inspiration of other seeking hearts.
The great ones speak their words and participate in the seemingly natural course of events solely for the good of man.
Even as Christ said, Father, I knew that thou hearest me always, but because of the people which stand by I said it, that they may believe that thou hast sent me.
During my visit at Ranbajpur with Ram Gopal, the sleepless saint, the omnipresent yogi who observed that I failed to bow before the Tarakeshwar shrine, he related the wondrous story of his first meeting with Babaji.
I sometimes left my isolated cave to sit at the feet of Lahiri Mahashai in Banaras, Ram Gopal told me.
One midnight, as I was silently meditating in a group of his disciples, the master made a surprising request.
Ram Gopal, he said, go at once to the Dasasamed bathing ghat.
I soon reached the secluded spot. The night was bright with moonlight and the glittering stars.
After I had sat in patient silence for a while, my attention was drawn to a huge stone slab near my feet.
It rose gradually, revealing an underground cave.
As the stone became stationary, held up by some unknown means, the draped form of a young and surpassingly lovely woman emerged from the cave and levitated high in the air. Surrounded by a soft halo, she slowly descended in front of me and stood, motionless, steeped in ecstasy. She finally stirred and spoke gently.
I am Mataji, the sister of Babaji. I have asked him and also Lahiri Mahashai to come to my cave tonight to discuss a matter of great importance.
A nebulous light was rapidly floating over the Ganges.
The strange luminescence was reflected in the opaque waters.
It approached nearer and nearer until, with a blinding flash, it appeared by the side of Mataji and condensed itself instantly into the human form of Lahiri Mahashai. He bowed humbly at the feet of the woman saint.
Before I had recovered from my bewilderment,
I was further wonderstruck to behold a circling mass of mystical light travelling in the sky. Descending swiftly, the flaming whirlpool neared our group and materialized itself into the body of a beautiful youth. I understood at once that he was Babaji. He looked like Lahiri Mahashai, though Babaji appeared much younger than his disciple and had long, bright hair. Lahiri Mahashai, Mataji and I knelt at the great Guru's feet. An ethereal sensation of beatific glory thrilled every fibre of my being as I touched his divine flesh. "Blessed sister," Babaji said, "I am intending to shed my form and plunge into the infinite current. I have already glimpsed your plan, beloved master. I wanted to discuss it with you tonight. Why should you leave your body?" The glorious woman looked at him beseechingly. "What is the difference if I wear a visible or an invisible wave on the ocean of my spirit?" Mataji replied with a quaint flash of wit, "Deathless Guru, if it makes no difference, then please do not ever relinquish your form." "Be it so," Babaji said solemnly, "I shall never leave my physical body. It will always remain visible to at least a small number of people on this earth. The Lord has spoken his own wish through your lips." As I listened in awe to the conversation between these exalted beings, the great Guru turned to me with a benign gesture. "Fear not, Ram Gopal," he said. "You are blessed to be a witness at the scene of this immortal promise." As the sweet melody of Babaji's voice faded away, his form and that of Lahiri Mahashai slowly levitated and moved backward over the Ganges. An aureole of dazzling light surrounded their bodies as they vanished into the night sky. Mataji's form floated to the cave and descended. The stone slab came down and closed over the cave, as if moved by invisible hands. Infinitely inspired, I wended my way back to Lahiri Mahashai's place. As I bowed before him in the early dawn, my guru smiled at me, understandingly. "I'm happy for you, Ram Gopal," he said. "Your desire to meet Babaji and Mataji, which you have often expressed to me, has found, at last, a wondrous fulfillment." My fellow disciples informed me that Lahiri Mahashai had not moved from his dais since my departure at midnight. He gave a wonderful discourse on immortality after you had left for the Dasasamed Ghat, one of the chelas told me. "For the first time, I fully realized the truth in the scriptural verses which state that a man of self-realization can appear at different places in two or more bodies at the same time." Lahiri Mahashai later explained to me many metaphysical points concerning the hidden divine plan for this earth, Ram Gopal concluded. "Babaji has been chosen by God to remain in his body for the duration of this particular world cycle. Ages will come and go. Still, the deathless master, beholding the drama of the centuries, shall be present on this stage terrestrial." Chapter 34. Materializing a Palace in the Himalayas. Babaji's first meeting with Lahiri Mahashai is an enthralling story, and one of the few that give us a detailed glimpse of the deathless guru. These words were Swami Kabalananda's preamble to a wondrous tale. The first time he recounted it, I was literally spellbound. On many other occasions, I coaxed my gentle Sanskrit tutor to repeat the story, which was later told me in substantially the same words by Sri Yukteswar. Both these disciples of Lahiri Mahashai had heard the awesome tale direct from the lips of their guru. My first meeting with Babaji took place in my 33rd year, Lahiri Mahashai had said. In the autumn of 1861, I was stationed in Danapur as an accountant in the military engineering department of the government. One morning, the office manager summoned me. "Lahiri," he said, "a telegram has just come from our main office. You are to be transferred to Ranikhet
where an army post is now being established. With one servant, I set out on the 500-mile trip. Travelling by horse and buggy, we arrived in 30 days at the Himalayan site of Raniket. My office duties were not onerous. I was able to spend many hours roaming the magnificent hills. A rumour reached me that great saints blessed the region with their presence. I felt a strong desire to see them. During a ramble one early afternoon, I was astounded to hear a distant voice calling my name. I continued my vigorous upward climb on Drongiri Mountain. A slight uneasiness beset me at the thought that I might not be able to retrace my steps before darkness descended over the jungle. I finally reached a small clearing whose sides were dotted with caves. On one of the rocky ledges stood a smiling young man, extending his hand in welcome. I noticed with astonishment that, except for his copper-coloured hair, he bore a remarkable resemblance to myself. "Lahiri, you have come." The saint addressed me affectionately in Hindi. "Rest here in this cave. It was I who called you." I entered a neat little grotto that contained several woolen blankets and a few kamandalas, water pots. "Lahiri, do you remember that seat?" The yogi pointed to a folded blanket in one corner. "No, sir." Somewhat dazed at the strangeness of my adventure, I added, "I must leave now before nightfall. I have business in the morning at my office." The mysterious saint replied in English, "The office was brought for you, and not you for the office." I was dumbfounded that this forest ascetic should not only speak English, but also paraphrase the words of Christ. I see my telegram took effect. The yogi's remark was incomprehensible to me. I asked its meaning. "I refer to the telegram that summoned you to these isolated parts. It was I who silently suggested to the mind of your superior officer that you be transferred to Raniket. When one feels his unity with mankind, all minds become transmitting stations through which he can work at will." He added, "Lahiri, surely this cave seems familiar to you?" As I maintained a bewildered silence, the saint approached and struck me gently on the forehead. At his magnetic touch, a wondrous current swept through my brain, releasing the sweet seed memories of my previous life. "I remember." My voice was half-choked with joyous sobs. "You are my guru, Babaji, who has belonged to me always." Scenes of the past arise vividly in my mind. Here, in this cave, I spent many years of my last incarnation. As ineffable recollections overwhelmed me, I tearfully embraced my master's feet. "For more than 3 decades, I have waited for you to return to me." Babaji's voice rang with celestial love. "You slipped away and disappeared into the tumultuous waves of the life beyond death. The magic wand of your karma touched you, and you were gone. Though you lost sight of me, never did I lose sight of you. I pursued you over the luminescent astral sea, where the glorious angels sail. Through gloom, storm, upheaval, and light I followed you, like a mother bird guarding her young. As you lived out your human term of womb life and emerged a babe, my eye was ever on you. When you covered your tiny form in the lotus posture, under the gurney sands in childhood, I was invisibly present. Patiently, month after month, year after year, I have watched over you, waiting for this perfect day. Now you're with me. Here is your cave, loved of yore. I have kept it ever clean and ready for you. Here is your hallowed asana blanket, where daily you sat to fill your expanding heart with God. Here is your bowl, from which you often drank the nectar prepared by me. See how I have kept the brass cup brightly polished, that some day you might drink again from it. My own, do you now understand?" "My guru, what can I say? I murmured brokenly. Where has one ever heard of such deathless love? I gazed long and ecstatically at my eternal treasure, my guru, in life and death. Lahiri, you need purification. Drink the oil in this bowl and lie down by the river. Babaji's practical wisdom, I reflected with a quick, reminiscent smile, was ever to the fore. I obeyed his directions. Though the icy Himalayan night was descending, a warm, comforting radiation began to pulsate within me. I marveled. Was the unknown oil endued with a cosmical heat? Bitter winds whipped around me in the darkness, shrieking a fierce challenge. The chill wavelets of the Gogesh River lapped now and then over my body, outstretched on the rocky bank. Tigers howled nearby, but my heart was free of fear. The radiant force, newly generated within me, conveyed an assurance of unassailable protection. Several hours passed swiftly. Faded memories of another life wove themselves into the present brilliant pattern of reunion with my divine guru. My solitary musings were interrupted by the sound of approaching footsteps. In the darkness, a man's hand gently helped me to my feet and gave me some dry clothing. Come, brother, my companion said. The master awaits you. He led the way through the forest. As we came to a turn in the path, the somber night was suddenly lit by a steady luminosity in the distance. Can that be the sunrise? I inquired. Surely the whole night has not passed. The hour is midnight, my guide laughed softly. Yonder light is the glow of a golden palace, materialized here tonight by the peerless Babaji. In the dim past, you once expressed a desire to enjoy the beauties of a palace. Our master is now satisfying your wish, thus freeing you from the last bond of your karma. He added, the magnificent palace will be the scene of your initiation tonight into Kriya Yoga. All your brothers here join in a paean of welcome, rejoicing at the end of your exile. Behold! Before us stood a vast palace of dazzling gold, ornamented with countless jewels, set amid landscaped gardens, reflected in tranquil pools, a spectacle of unparalleled grandeur. Towering archways were intricately inlaid with great diamonds, sapphires, and emeralds. Men of angelic countenance were stationed by gates, redly resplendent with rubies. I followed my companion into a spacious reception hall. The odors of incense and roses wafted through the air. Dim lamps shed a multicolored glow. Small groups of devotees, some fair, some dark-skinned, chanted softly or sat silently in the meditative posture, immersed in inner peace. A vibrant joy pervaded the atmosphere. Feast your eyes, enjoy the artistic splendors of this palace, for it has been brought into being solely in your honor, my guide remarked, smiling sympathetically. As I exclaimed in wonder, Brother, I said, the beauty of this structure surpasses the bounds of human imagination. Please explain to me the mystery of its origin. I will gladly enlighten you. My companion's dark eyes sparkled with wisdom. There is nothing inexplicable about this materialization. The whole cosmos is a projected thought of the Creator. The heavy clod of the earth, floating in space, is a dream of God's. He made all things out of his mind, even as man, in his dream consciousness, reproduces and vivifies a creation with its creatures. The Lord first formed the earth as an idea. He quickened it. Atomic energy and then matter came into being. He coordinated earth atoms into a solid sphere. All its molecules are held together by the will of God. When he withdraws his will, all earth atoms will be transformed into energy.
atomic energy will return to its source, consciousness. The earth idea will disappear from objectivity. The substance of a dream is held in materialization by the subconscious thought of the dreamer. When that cohesive thought is withdrawn, in wakefulness, the dream and its elements dissolve. A man closes his eyes and erects a dream creation, which, on awakening, he effortlessly dematerializes. He follows the divine archetypal pattern. Similarly, when he awakens in cosmic consciousness, he effortlessly dematerializes the illusion of a cosmic dream universe. In tune with the infinite, all-accomplishing will, Babaji is able to command the elemental atoms to combine and manifest themselves in any form. This golden palace, instantaneously brought into being, is real, in the same sense that the earth is real. Babaji created this beautiful mansion out of his mind and is holding its atoms together by the power of his will, even as God's thought created the earth and his will maintains it. He added, when this structure has served its purpose, Babaji will dematerialize it. As I remained silent in awe, my guide made a sweeping gesture. This shimmering palace, superbly embellished with jewels, has not been built by human effort. Its gold and gems were not laboriously mined. It stands, solidly, a monumental challenge to man. Whoever realizes himself as a son of God, even as Babaji has done, can reach any goal by the infinite powers hidden within him. A common stone secretly contains stupendous atomic energies. Even so, the lowliest mortal is a powerhouse of divinity. The sage picked up from a nearby table a graceful vase whose handle was blazing with diamonds. Our great guru created this palace by solidifying myriads of free cosmic rays, he went on. Touch this vase and its diamonds. They will pass all the tests of sensory experience. I examined the vase. Its jewels were worthy of a king's collection. I passed my hand over the room walls, thick with glistening gold. Deep satisfaction spread over my mind. A desire, hidden in my subconsciousness from lives now gone, seemed simultaneously gratified and extinguished. My stately companion led me through ornate arches and corridors into a series of chambers richly furnished in the style of an emperor's palace. We entered an immense hall. In the center stood a golden throne, encrusted with jewels that shed a dazzling medley of colors. There, in lotus posture, sat the supreme Babaji. I knelt on the shining floor at his feet. Lahiri, are you still feasting on your dream desires for a golden palace? My guru's eyes were twinkling like his own sapphires. Wake! All your earthly thirsts are about to be quenched forever. He murmured some mystic words of blessing. My son, arise, receive your initiation into the kingdom of God through Kriya Yoga. Babaji stretched out his hand. A homa, sacrificial fire, appeared, surrounded by fruits and flowers. I received the liberating yogic technique before this flaming altar. The rites were completed in the early dawn. In my ecstatic state, I felt no need for sleep. I wandered about the palace rooms, filled with treasures and exquisite objets d'art, and visited the gardens. I noticed nearby the caves and barren mountain ledges that I had seen yesterday, but then they had not adjoined a great building and flowered terraces. Re-entering the palace, fabulously glistening in the cold Himalayan sunlight, I sought the presence of my master. He was still enthroned, surrounded by many quiet disciples. Lahiri, you're hungry, Babaji added. Close your eyes. When I reopened them, the enchanting palace and its gardens had disappeared. My own body and the forms of Babaji and his disciples were now all seated on the bare ground at the exact site of the vanished palace, not far from the sunlit entrances of the rocky grottos. I recalled that my guide had remarked that the palace would be dematerialized, its captive atoms released into the thought essences from which they had sprung. Although stunned, I looked trustingly at my guru. I knew not what to expect next on this day of miracles. The purpose for which the palace was created has now been served, Babaji explained. He lifted an earthen vessel from the ground. Put your hand there and receive whatever food you desire. I touched the broad, empty bowl. Hot buttered luchis, curry and sweetmeats appeared. As I ate them, I noticed that the bowl remained ever filled. At the end of the meal, I looked around for water. My guru pointed to the bowl before me. The food had vanished. In its place was water. Few mortals know that the kingdom of God includes the kingdom of mundane fulfillments, Babaji observed. The divine realm extends to the earthly, but the latter, illusory in nature, does not contain the essence of reality. Beloved Guru, last night you demonstrated for me the link of beauty in heaven and earth. I smiled at memories of the vanished palace. Surely no simple yogi had ever received initiation into the august mysteries of spirit amidst surroundings of more impressive luxury. I gazed tranquilly at the stark contrast of the present scene. The gaunt ground, the sky roof, the caves offering primitive shelter, all seemed a gracious natural setting for the seraphic saints around me. I sat that afternoon on my blanket, hallowed by associations of past life realizations. My divine guru approached and passed his hand over my head. I entered the Nirvikalpa Samadhi state, remaining unbrokenly in its bliss for 7 days. Crossing the successive strata of self-knowledge, I penetrated the deathless realms of reality. All delusive limitations dropped away. My soul was fully established on the altar of the cosmic spirit. On the 8th day, I fell at my guru's feet and implored him to keep me always near him in this sacred wilderness. My son, Babaji said, embracing me, your role in this incarnation must be played before the gaze of the multitude. Prenatally blessed by many lives of lonely meditation, you must now mingle in the world of men. A deep purpose underlay the fact that you did not meet me this time until you were already a married man, with modest family and business responsibilities. You must put aside your thoughts of joining our secret band in the Himalayas. Your life lies amid the city crowds, serving as an example of the ideal yogi householder. The cries of many bewildered worldly men and women have not fallen unheard on the ears of the great ones, he went on. You have been chosen to bring spiritual solace through Kriya Yoga to numerous earnest seekers. The millions who are encumbered by family ties and heavy worldly duties will take new heart from you, a householder like themselves. You should guide them to understand that the highest yogic attainments are not barred to the family man. Even in the world, the yogi who faithfully discharges his responsibilities without personal motive or attachment treads the sure path of enlightenment. No necessity compels you to leave the world, for inwardly you have already sundered its every karmic tie. Not of this world, you must yet be in it. Many years still remain, during which you should conscientiously fulfill your family, business, civic, and spiritual duties. A sweet new breath of divine hope will penetrate the arid hearts of worldly men. From your balanced life, they will understand that liberation is dependent on inner rather than outer renunciations. How remote seemed my family, the office, the world, as I listened to my guru in the high Himalayan solitudes. Yet adamantine truth rang in his words.
I submissively agreed to leave this blessed haven of peace. Babaji instructed me in the ancient rigid rules that govern the transmission of the yogic art from guru to disciple. Bestow the Kriya key only on qualified chelas, Babaji said. He who vows to sacrifice all in the quest of the divine is fit to unravel the final mysteries of life through the science of meditation. Angelic Guru, as you have already favored mankind by resurrecting the lost Kriya art, will you not increase that benefit by relaxing the strict requirements for discipleship? I gazed beseechingly at Babaji. I pray that you permit me to communicate Kriya to all sincere seekers, even though at first they may not be able to vow themselves to complete inner renunciation. The tortured men and women of the world, pursued by the threefold suffering, need special encouragement. They may never attempt the road to freedom if Kriya initiation be withheld from them.
Be it so. The divine wish has been expressed through you. Give Kriya to all who humbly ask you for help. The merciful Guru replied.
After a silence, Babaji added, repeat to each of your disciples this majestic promise from the Bhagavad Gita. Svalpamapyasya dharmasya trayate mahato bhayat. Even a little practice of this dharma, religious rite or righteous action, will save you from great fear, mahato bhayat, the colossal sufferings inherent in the repeated cycles of birth and death. As I knelt the next morning at my guru's feet for a farewell blessing, he sensed my deep reluctance to leave him. There is no separation for us, my beloved child. He touched my shoulder affectionately. Wherever you are, whenever you call me, I shall be with you instantly. Consoled by his wondrous promise and rich with the newly found gold of God wisdom, I wended my way down the mountain. At the office, I was welcomed by my fellow employees, who for 10 days had thought me lost in the Himalayan jungles. A letter soon arrived from the head office. Lahiri should return to the Danapur office, it read. His transfer to Raniket occurred by error. Another man should have been sent to assume the Raniket duties. I smiled, reflecting on the hidden cross-currents in the events that had led me to this farthermost spot of India. Before returning to Danapur, I spent a few days with a Bengali family in Moradabad. A party of 6 friends gathered to greet me. As I turned the conversation to spiritual subjects, my host observed gloomily, "Oh, in these days, India is destitute of saints." "Bapu," I protested warmly, "of course there are still great masters in this land." In a mood of exalted fervour, I felt impelled to relate my miraculous experiences in the Himalayas. The little company was politely incredulous. "Lahiri," one man said soothingly, "your mind has been under a strain in those rarefied mountain airs. This is some daydream you have recounted." Burning with the enthusiasm of truth, I spoke without due thought. "If I call him, my guru will appear right in this house." Interest gleamed in every eye. It was no wonder that the group was eager to behold such a phenomenon. Half reluctantly, I asked for a quiet room and 2 new woolen blankets. "The master will materialize from the ether," I said. "Remain silently outside the door. I shall soon call you." I sank into the meditative state, humbly summoning my guru. The darkened room became filled with a dim, soothing glow. The luminous figure of Babaji emerged. "Lahiri, do you call me for a trifle?" The master's gaze was stern. "Truth is for earnest seekers, not for those of idle curiosity. It is easy to believe when one sees. No soul searchings are then necessary. Supersensual truth is deservedly discovered by those who overcome their natural materialistic skepticism." He added gravely, "Let me go." I fell entreatingly at his feet. Holy Guru, I realize my serious error. I humbly ask pardon. It was to create faith in these spiritually blinded minds that I ventured to call you. Because you have graciously appeared at my prayer, please do not depart without bestowing a blessing on my friends. Unbelievers though they be, at least they were willing to investigate the truth of my strange assertions.
Very well. I will stay a while. I do not wish your word discredited before your friends.
Babaji's face had softened, but he added gently, Henceforth, my son, I shall come whenever you need me, not always when you call me. Tense silence reigned in the little group when I opened the door. As if mistrusting their senses, my friends stared at the lustrous figure on the blanket seat.
This is mass hypnotism, one man laughed blatantly.
No one could possibly have entered this room without our knowledge. Babaji advanced smilingly and motioned to each one to touch the warm, solid flesh of his body. Doubts dispelled, my friends prostrated themselves on the floor in awed repentance.
Let halwa be prepared. Babaji made this request, I knew, further to assure the group of his physical reality.
While the porridge was boiling, the divine guru chatted affably. Great was the metamorphosis of these doubting Thomases into devout St. Paul's. After we had eaten, Babaji blessed each of us in turn. There was a sudden flash. We witnessed the instantaneous dechemicalization of the electronic elements of Babaji's body into a spreading vaporous light. The God-tuned willpower of the Master had loosened its grasp of the ether atoms held together as his body. Forthwith, the trillions of tiny lifetronic sparks faded into the infinite reservoir. With my own eyes, I have seen the conqueror of death. Maitra, one of the group, spoke reverently. His face was transfigured with the joy of his recent awakening. The Supreme Guru played with time and space as a child plays with bubbles. I have beheld one with the keys of heaven and earth. I soon returned to Danapur, Lahiri Mahashaya had concluded. Firmly anchored in the spirit, again I assumed the manifold family and business obligations of a householder. Lahiri Mahashaya also related to Swami Kebalananda and Sri Yukteswar the story of another meeting with Babaji. The occasion was one of many on which the Supreme Guru fulfilled his promise. I shall come whenever you need me. The scene was a Kumbha Mela at Allahabad. Lahiri Mahashaya told his disciples, I had gone there during a short vacation from my office duties. As I wandered amidst the throng of monks and sadhus that had come from great distances to attend the holy festival, I noticed an ash-smeared ascetic who was holding a begging bowl. The thought arose in my mind that the man was hypocritical, wearing the outward symbols of renunciation without a corresponding inward grace. No sooner had I passed the ascetic than my astounded eye fell on Babaji. He was kneeling in front of a matted-haired anchorite. Guruji, I hastened to his side. Sir, what are you doing here? I am washing the feet of this renunciant, and then I shall clean his cooking utensils. Babaji smiled at me like a little child. I knew he was intimating that he wanted me to criticize no one, but to see the Lord as residing equally in all body temples, whether of superior or inferior men. The great Guru added, By serving wise and ignorant sadhus, I am learning the greatest of virtues, pleasing to God above all others, humility.